morning and welcome to Countrywide. And this morning, we go seaweed gathering in Cundinagaliva. We ask, do farmers need prenups? And we check in with the new Ross Rugby Club, home of legend Tadhg Furlong. But first, Irish farmers are being encouraged to include traditional Irish breeds among the livestock on their farms. Breeds including Dexter cows, Galway sheep, Kerry bog ponies or old Irish goats, to name but a few. And with financial rewards available under the Acre scheme, which rewards farmers for doing things to improve the environment, there is a new interest in these rare breeds. Take, for example, the Dexter cow. The number of members of the Irish Dexter Cattle Society tripled in 2022 alone. And I understand every available female Dexter cow is being put into calf to meet the huge demand for Dexters. So what is the charm of the Dexter? I travelled to County Monaghan to meet Sirka MacPhillips in Glasla, where she farms with her husband Connor, as well as rearing two young daughters, Searla and Baveen, and a herd of 10 Dexter cattle.
Come on. Now here they come, all 10 of them. Dexter cattle are one of the few native Irish rare breeds. There's only three recognised rare breeds of cattle in Ireland. And we really had an interest in conservation farming and promoting rare breeds. And we kind of stumbled across Dexter at a food market in Letterkenny when there was a couple of ladies there cooking up Dexter burgers. And we thought they were just, the taste and flavour was just amazing. And so we kind of went down a bit of a rabbit hole researching the breed and figured that they'd be perfect for our land. But they're very hardy. So we have a nice bit of land here. It's quite dry, but we wanted cattle that would be light underfoot, that could stay out all year round, and that we could use, as I said, in terms of our conservation grazing. So what they do is they clear brambles, they eat the fruit and the berries and the nuts that are in the trees and the hedgerows. And they're easy handled in the sense that they're small, they're hardy. You don't need to give them any injections, medicines, dosing, nothing at all. They're outside all year round and not a bother on them.
The weather's getting a little bit wild here. The wind is getting up. But what is the temperament of the Dexters like?
It's funny. Some people say they're very quiet. But our experience of them is that there's a wildness in them, which is lovely. It's that they're descended from a mountain cow. Like, so there is a bit of wildness in them. I just wouldn't want to be in a corner with one of the bulls now, you know, especially because we leave the horns on. But look, there's a spark and an energy in them, which is great. As I said, it's lovely to see them coming running down the field, bound with energy, like. But they're a unique kind of temperament, I suppose. Yeah, they're probably the happiest guys you come across. Okay, Brenda, come on, we'll walk up to the next field and see a few more of the Dexters.
Brilliant.
So your hedgerows, you're very passionate about that.
Yeah, I suppose that's an indicator that you're using regenerative farming practices, is that you try and maintain dense hedgerows of good mixture of native Irish trees, bushes, fruits and nuts and things in it. So they're fantastic in terms of wildlife conservation. We've seen, even in the past few years, loads of different varieties of birds that we hadn't previously seen. You know, Connor had been working on the house here in the land for the past 10 years or so, over and back before we started farming. And the change that we've seen in terms of biodiversity has been immense, even in a short period of time. The past year over there, we planted about 300 new trees in along the banks of a stream that we have. So yeah, lots going on. There's always kind of work to be done. There's always a hole to be filled somewhere.
So can I go back to how you got into Dexters? Yourself and your husband, Connor, did you come from a farming background?
No, absolutely the opposite. I'm from a council estate and my background's in human rights law and my husband's a scientist.
Go back. Your background is in what?
Human rights law.
No way.
Yeah.
Where?
I worked for about 10 years in Northern Ireland in the prison service and in the community and voluntary work in around Belfast. So all around human rights in communities and working with minority groups, groups that have been impacted with different social justice issues. So not in any way related to farming. But you know what, I see that as a plus because we can start from scratch. And as I said, using things like regenerative practices, it's not the way that things, although it's the way that it would have been done years ago, it's not common now. So you're able to start from scratch. You're not having to unlearn. If that helps, you know, if makes any sense.
And your husband,
Connor is, he's a medical scientist. So he works in the hospital laboratory in microbiology. So that's helpful in terms of skill set because he knows about diseases and bacteria and things like that there. So it helps.
You were a human rights lawyer. Your husband's a medical scientist. There has to have been some conversations or some desire to change your lifestyle.
It was a meandering. It wasn't a straight road. the house across the road from Connor's home house came up for sale. It was a derelict cottage, and he took that on, and he spent probably 5 or 6 years while he was working in other places starting to do that up. And a job came up in Cavan, so there was an opportunity then to move back to Monaghan and to take over the land and start farming.
This is a big life change. You haven't been well. Do you mind sharing that? Because in a way, your new lifestyle has helped you through that.
Culture night last year, actually, I had been in town with the girls to some events and came home, went to bed and suddenly got a sharp headache. And the next morning, I wasn't able to stand up. It was such extreme vertigo. And eventually, I went to the hospital because I thought I'd maybe caught a nerve in my neck or something. I wasn't really sure what was going on. And I'd had migraines in the past, but this is completely different. And anyway, long story short, it turned out I'd had a stroke. Completely shock. When I've talked to other stroke survivors, young stroke survivors, the shock and the mental impact is one of the biggest things, because it's just completely out of the blue. It's stroke is something you always associate with older people, and it's a life-threatening event. You know, it could have ended up paralysed, could have ended up obviously dead, you know, but I was very lucky. And I think just being out here and having this peace and sanctuary and the chance to recuperate in the fresh air and just being around the Dexter, and we have a few hens and we have a cat and a dog, and, you know, just, yeah, no, it has helped. But I mean, above all, having the support of your family and friends around you to help with two lovely little girls, but who need plenty of attention and plenty of work, you know. So all of those things combined, I've been really, really fortunate to make a strong recovery.
So with everything going on, you do have to still run a business, and these Dexters do need to make money. So talk me through the process of getting the beef to the customer.
Yeah, we're very fortunate in the part of the country that we're in, because we have a low throughput abattoir, which is only 10 minutes over the road, run by a farmer butcher, and we work really closely with them. So we take an animal over to them on a Monday, it's inspected, it's slaughtered, and then we have it dry aged for 3 weeks, and then I work literally side by side with Martin, our butcher, and I'll have sold the majority of the beef before I even step into the place, because we do it all pre-orders over social media. One of the benefits of being a small producer is that you can set the price rather than being at the mercy of the factories that a lot of farmers are. And you'll see protests about the price of beef going down or up, or price of milk and stuff like that. But when you're actually producing, you're cutting out the middleman, you can set a fair price for your product. And that's what we're doing. And thankfully, our customers are happy enough to pay it.
Hope I'm not intruding too much, Sarka, but do you have any beef I could taste?
It just so happens that my brother Shawnee is 2 minutes over the road, and he's a food truck, and he's ready to serve us up some of our burgers.
And he knows we're coming.
He knows we're coming. He's ready to go.
Lead the way. Where are we going? Will I follow you?
You follow me. We're just heading under the bridge here, down the road, take a left and head towards Glaslough Village.
Okay, and what's this food truck called?
It's called Blasta. Now we're just going across the street. Brendan, this is my brother Sean.
Hello.
Oh, I love your food truck.
We've basically got two identical trailers, one that we kind of keep for corporate catering and weddings and the likes, and then this one go around markets in different towns and just pop up and just keep the name out there. So I'm going to cook a few of these bad boys up, and we'll put a few of our wee garnishes and stuff on there as well. So
Sean, while you're cooking the burger here, how did you start the business?
I think it was kind of inspired by a guy I worked for in Melbourne, and he was called Sliders on Tires. So I was full-time in a restaurant and then a part-time working for this guy in a food truck. He was putting a high-end spin on kind of 21st birthdays, 30ths. Over there was the first time I'd seen this whole day two of a wedding kind of crack. So another good thing with these now, you wouldn't use any oil, really. If I was cooking this on a big flat top now at a festival or at a party, just get the thing nice and hot and press them down in the oil. The fat will start just to render it, you know, so...
I hope you're hungry, Brenda, because Johnny's got the burgers ready to go now.
God, they smell amazing.
Well, you'll not be hungry in the drive home anyway.
I certainly won't. That is beautiful. The best of luck to you, Sarka. Thank you so much.
Thanks very much for visiting us, Brenda.
And that is Sarka MacPhillips from Drumsheeny Dexter, and her brother Sean in his Blasta food truck, ending my report there. And if you think that Dexter is the breed for you, then hitch a trailer to your Jeep and head to the Dexter Cattle Society sale at 1 o'clock today, with a viewing from noon of Dexter cows, heifers, weaning heifers and bulls. And that's all happening at Gortmar, County Galway. Details on dextercattlesociety.ie. Now, they say that love and marriage go together like a horse and carriage. But with divorce more and more commonplace in the country, it's fair to say that the horse has been buckling off the carriage in recent times. On a farm, a divorce leads to complication around the division of land between the original farm family and the person, usually a woman, who marries in. This has led to a number of farmers to consider the idea of a prenuptial agreement or a prenup before tying the knot. This week, when Hannah Quinn Mulligan sat down with her mother Kate, her grandmother Catherine, around the farmyard kitchen table for a cup of tea, the conversation turned to prenups. By the way, the door you're going to hear opening and closing in the background is the chimney sweep Liam going quietly about his business, which is wise enough, I think, to stay out of this particular exchange of views.
Jim, come on, good boy, good dog, come on. Good boy. Hey, Gran.
Hey, Mummy. Hello. Well, how did the milking go?
Ask the master milker over there.
They're lovely. They were perfect.
For tea first, yes.
So you know the way I wrote this thing about prenups this week?
Yes.
In the paper, mm-hmm. And it got quite a big reaction.
Yes.
But I was wondering what you two thought about prenups and farms.
I suppose my point was just that if two people get married and say one is an accountant and one is a solicitor, then they're not going to be, if the marriage fails, they're not going to be looking at taking half of the other person's future potential earnings. That person's still going to earn a full salary. Whereas if a marriage breaks up and somebody's taking half of a farm, that's your potential income halved for the rest of your working life.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I mean, it's funny that it's become such a discussion point because prenups aren't even legally valid in Ireland right now.
They're not even binding.
No.
And I think in any case, a judge would have to take into consideration the circumstances, like are there children? You know, there are other things to take into account.
Most valuable cow on the farm.
If the intention is of both people in the marriage to work the farm as a business, then that's got to be discussed and decided before you get married.
I think that just takes away the room for things to evolve. And I think the issue for me is that, like, there's still a huge number of women who work on farms every single day but never actually own the land. You know, there's 120,000, 130,000 farmers in Ireland, and yet only about 15,000 are women. And yet we know from CSO figures that 70,000 women work on farms every day, 40,000 of them are wives. And those wives are never really going to have their input validated. And I think if you turn around and say to a woman entering a marriage, hello, here's a plate of scones and a prenup by your future mother and father-in-law, that is going to put anyone off, because a farm is a slightly different thing to getting into business with, you know, a solicitor as well. Yeah, you know, a farm, you're expected to raise children on a farm and you're expected to work the farm as well. And then potentially you're never going to own it. And yet women, we know, are also the main drivers of, say, farm diversification, which is only going to become more important going into the future as well.
So in terms of diversifying in doing, you know, Airbnb or, you know, some other kind of farm enterprise, then really people should say, not look at farming so much as, oh, I'm marrying into land and a farm, but I'm marrying into a business. And if I am going to be an integral part of that business, then I want a business partnership.
I don't know, Granny, what do you think?
Well, I think that the idea of a prenup doesn't inspire confidence to start off with. And, you know, where does the romance and love aspect come?
Well, trust.
Trust is a big thing, yes. So in some ways, it doesn't seem like a very good start. But on the other hand, I think it could work from the point of view that, say, you know, the old adage about walking up the aisle with a farm of land and walking down with half a farm, that it could help sort of unite the two families, bring the two families together and have maybe a better relationship because of the prenup or because of having sat down and talked about it.
But because everybody knows where they stand.
Yes. Yeah.
Or what the intentions are from the outset.
And I guess the prenup isn't necessarily in the man's favour. It takes into account certain things. But I don't know, then do you take into account, like, oh, you get an extra 20 acres of land after a divorce if you have an extra child or something like that? You know, how do you...
very calculated.
It is, but I mean, how do you start quantifying a division of land and property? And the issue is men are still so much more asset-rich than women.
Mm. But that happens in any divorce. I mean, in any divorce in this country, the husband, the male partner, usually ends up about 25% richer having divorced than he was when he was married, and the women end up obviously 25% poorer and usually with the lion's share of childminding and those responsibilities.
And women are already poor because we get usually a lower pension as well in old age and more at risk of poverty in older age as well. So who does the prenup really protect?
But my point is, in this country we have such small farms that really making them economically viable is so difficult. But if you're looking at splitting up that land, it's impossible. It'd be the same sort of situation with inheritance. If the land is continually divided into smaller and smaller and smaller lots, how is any kind of agricultural industry going to be viable?
Yes, that's a very good point, actually.
Would you want me to get a prenup?
I think that's what this boils down to. I think actually this is what we're all in the back of our minds thinking is, would I advise Hannah to get a prenup?
Well, the fact that it doesn't stand up in a court of law is worrying. And yes.
I'd say to be on the safe side, just don't get married.
I think that makes it very simple.
It's
problem solved.
Oh dear.
Yeah. Please.
Oh dear, that was Hannah and her mother and her grandmother advising her just not to get married. And you know what? I feel I have a little inch of sympathy for any man that might go into that kitchen table. He'd really want to have his manners about him. Anyway, on the other side of Limerick, agricultural solicitor Aisling Meehan has a busy practice and she knows what farmers are talking about. Good morning, Aisling. This is not a new topic for conversation. Why do you think it's gaining currency again?
Good morning, Brenda. It's gaining currency because I think for a couple of different reasons, one being the price of land has increased dramatically in the last couple of months or even years. Secondly, I suppose, given the nature of spouses and, you know, typically, you know, on farmers could be they male or female, could be married to, we'll call it professional people who themselves are bringing, you know, have a good income, potentially have their own assets in terms of houses, etc. So It can protect both parties' interests. And thirdly, I suppose where from a personal perspective, where I saw it being very prevalent was that the IFA organised a series of meetings earlier this year in the spring, and it was regional meetings, very well attended. It was on succession and there was over 2,000 people across those four meetings. And it kept coming up again and again and again as part of those meetings that I'd never seen to that extent before. And even in my own practice, it's surfacing as a consideration or an issue as part of succession planning. So there certainly seems to be a much stronger appetite for them.
And I suppose the question is, they're not legal. So why are they not legal yet?
Because there hasn't just been the appetite from a legislative point of view. There's no reason why they shouldn't. I mean, a prenup is a type of contract. There's no reason why they shouldn't be enforceable. Prior to the Divorce Act, under Article 41 of the Constitution, it would obstruct the enforceability of those agreements, but not so much more. It's just that, I suppose, governments haven't been lobbied strongly enough and that people haven't really wanted them to any great extent. But I know certainly the farm organisations are becoming a bit more vocal about it. I know that the Law Society did a report in 2019 where they called for them to be legally we'll say for legislation to be introduced to allow them to be legally enforced. But at the same time, I suppose that certain protections will be built in such that, you know, that there's separate independent legal advice for the parties they can't be made more than, we'll say, than less than 28 days before an intended marriage. And certainly, you know, there has to be full disclosure of financial means before you go into it. And then obviously you have to have them reviewed, you know, circumstances change. So if there's kids, if people change jobs, you know, if people, you know, I'm seeing a lot now of with couples on farms, you know, where maybe the professional, there will be a professional partner, be the accountant or be they a scientist or a HR type person. And like they're leaving maybe industry and they're becoming more involved in the farm because they have a very unique skill set, which I feel can, you know, they can feel can add to the farm. And because farm, you know, farming is a business, as we all know, and like, you know, small changes can have huge economies of scale. So if anything, you know, I think in that situation, but in that situation as well, also, you know, they're providing an income. And, you know, once the farm is viable enough to provide that income. Just one other thing, I suppose, the other thing just to be aware of it is like, you know, I know that Catherine mentioned there, there's that old adage about, you know, you walk up the aisle with a full farm
and down with half a farm.
And that simply isn't true. Like I often come across in practice here, you know, that people, I'd say, you know, what do you actually own? And they say, oh, sure, I'm married, sure, I only own half the farm now. That's not the case. Like, you know, unless you legally transfer ownership of the farm or put it into joint names, like whoever owns the land continues to own it. And like they have the freedom to do what they want, would it be a transfer it or sell it? And they don't necessarily have to consult a partner or a spouse. So if anything, a spouse can be very vulnerable in situations where, you know, unless in a marital breakdown situation, they don't really have much rights. And that was an issue that came up in the National Dialogue for Women in Agriculture earlier this year, as the rapporteur is one of the, as part of that National Dialogue was organised by the Department of Ag and the Department of Finance. So they're focused on that, that, you know, that we'll say there is vulnerability there on farms where ownership isn't in joint names.
Now, I don't mean to divulge too much into Hannah's life, but Hannah's mother and her grandmother both agreed she could avoid all the complications of a prenup by simply not getting married. But if Hannah was to live with somebody, she actually has more rights. Is that correct?
It's a brilliant point because like currently there is a type of prenup in a situation where...
Sorry, one second.
Where...
Sorry, Hannah. Go ahead. Go ahead, Ashley.
There is a type of prenup in a non-marital situation in that in the Certain Rights and Obligations of Cohabitants Act, if you've been living with somebody in an intimate and committed relationship for 5 years, you can have a type of prenup. So and there's a redress scheme for what's called a financially vulnerable dependent, and that reduces to a 2-year period if there's a child of that relationship. So that's kind of bit of a nonsense, really, that you can have a prenup in a situation where you're not married and yet you can't have one in a situation where you are married. So so marriage or not married is not necessarily the solution or the answer either.
Maybe it's the conscious uncoupling. What do you think?
That perhaps, might be the way forward. I hope it wouldn't put Hannah off.
No, let's not exactly. Do that. Let's not do that. There's so much to talk about there, Aisling, and I really appreciate you coming on to our programme this morning because I do understand there's a little matter of an under six camogie match calling you. Who's playing
absolutely.
And who are they against?
I have my two daughters, 5 and 3, are playing, they've training this morning, and then the 6-year-old is heading off to a blitz in Kilmaley. So so mother duties and father duties call.
Well, look, the best of luck to them all. Enjoy
thank
it.
You.
And that's Ashley Mean of Ashley Mean Agricultural Solicitors. And remember, you just have to have a chat with your own solicitor. They'll be able to advise you on your own circumstances. We're on 51551 and after the break we're off seaweed gathering in Coondé na Gaillimh.
Email countrywide@rte.ie. Countrywide on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back to the programme this morning. Now, as well as a certain match in the Stade de France, there's another event taking place in Paris this weekend. It's an EU summit conference to raise awareness on the future role of seaweed and other marine algae in sectors like human food, animal feed, cosmetics, biopackaging, or carbon capture. Now, wild harvesting of seaweed has been a long tradition on Ireland's coastline. And down on the shoreline in Cundinagaliva, Noel Lee of Connemara Seaweed Company harvests. He harvests wild seaweed by hand, using only a knife, as is the family tradition. He employs 5 full-time staff, and they produce a range of edible seaweed products at Ross of Eel. Laura Siggins went for a windy walk along the shoreline, collecting seaweed with Noel, and he shared his thoughts about the future of seaweed.
I'm a tron show the end of one because be my bind after seeking to go famine excellent.
A strong southerly gale is whipping up the Atlantic shoreline near Indervon, where I am following Noel Lee from Littermallon in the Connemara Gaeltacht as he picks his way deftly over rocks and across pools in search of edible seaweeds like bladderwrack, alaria, carrageen moss, depending on the season. We're snacking on some nori as he tells me how he became involved.
Well, my father had a haulage business delivering seaweed when I was a child. Like, so there were 7 different seaweed factories between Galway and Mayo and Conyclare. So he used to deliver 5 days a week to different factories. Like, so I'd always an interest because my father was involved in, and my, you know, we were born beside the shore anyway, so we would see everybody harvesting. And
yeah.
And on the boats, harvesting seaweed and pulling seaweed and stuff. So, you know, we grew up with it, like, so.
Yeah.
It was always an interest with me anyway, you know. We used to be chewing away at the Dillisk or the... We'd be carrying mass for the coals and then nori then for the sprinkling, sort of. With always a bit of interest in it, so it fitted in nicely. Yeah. But making a living out of it, yeah.
It's hard work, though, the wild harvesting.
It can be, yeah. It's good for the head, but bad for the back. it's therapeutic being harvesting it, but it can be. But, oh yeah, it's fairly manual. It can be, but everybody who works on the seaweed, they enjoy it too. Like, it's when you're out in the nature and stuff as well. It's nice species to be working with.
So where we are down at the trawl by the Relic, there's different species that you would harvest here.
Yes, well, maybe 7 or 8 are this different, but you might have to go to different coastline to get different species. It's a bit rough, so you won't probably get the Escophyllum or the Bladrex. You don't get much of it there, but you get most of the edible seaweeds in the shoreline here.
Yeah. And you got a good bit of nori there. That's and you'd right, you'd use that yourself?
Yeah, I'd use nori. We don't get much nori in Ireland. It's mostly in Asia, but you get small amounts, but we'd like to get it, but it doesn't grow in abundance in Ireland.
So how long would you keep picking before you take a break?
You know the jealous can most is 3 hours, like, you know the jealous, 1.5 hours before and after, and after that you don't see the jealous disappear.
You're living by the tides as well, aren't
yeah.
you? So the EU is holding this algae awareness summit and they're very excited about the idea of seaweed feeding the world. You'd need less than 10% of the world's oceans to cultivate enough seaweed to feed everyone. What do you think of that?
I think it's a good bit to go yet, like, but I think in the future there will be big space for growing seaweed because it grows very well. There's no negatives about it. You don't need to feed it any fertilizer. You don't need to feed anything. Just you get a wild plant, you spawn it in a lab, and then you put it on ropes and it grows automatically. And within 6-7 months, you'll have maybe 3 to 4 or 5 meters of beautiful seaweed, like 100% organic. There's no additives, like, it's just a dream. It's a dream. Yeah, so I can see a big future in it, but it's not there yet. Like, there's a lot of marketing to be done yet, and the big food companies have to come in and start using it when it's not there yet, but I'm sure it will be. So I have a premises in Ross of Eel and I do 13 different species, but it's only last year a European customer approached us and they wanted some more seaweed, so they're incorporating it into a meatball. So what they're doing is they're taking some of the meat out and putting seaweed in.
So this European company is interested in health ratings on foods?
They have a rating in Europe, it's like the energy rating, but A, B, C and D for food, for health. So their meatballs were D, but when they put in the seaweed, they can move it up to B. and they call it a hybrid food. I think that's good because the farmers still have a big input. I think that's where the future of seaweed farming will be.
Right, okay. So do you think there is great potential in Ireland?
Oh, there is, yeah. Oh, we're a perfect coastline for seaweed farming, yeah. So it'll be very interesting. We need to look at the future. There's big change coming and we have to play our part in this carbon neutral economy. So I think seaweed fits in perfectly with that. So, and it suits fishermen as well, and you know, isolated place out coastline. So it'll blend in nicely, I think, with the future.
And that was Noel Lee of the Connemara Seaweed Company speaking to Laura Siggins, one of 43 seaweed companies operating in Ireland. Now, I know all around the country, people are asking each other, where are you watching the match? There is such a great interest in the Rugby World Cup. The Irish team are playing so well, and despite their victory so far, this match against Scotland in the Stade de France in Paris will be crucial. There is always a farmer, it seems, on the Irish rugby team. And tonight, Tadhg Furlan will be carrying that flag. And down in New Ross, every member of New Ross Rugby Club is bursting with pride. One of their own, playing in a World Cup, impossibly the best Irish team ever. I'm telling you, I'm getting worked up already. And I'm sure David Stoney Burke, who's the ex-president of New Ross Rugby Club, Brendan Roach, the current one, and Owen Furlong, Tadhg's brother, are pretty worked up as well. Good morning, David.
Morning, Brenda. Woohoo!
Oh my God.
What an introduction.
It's not to you now, Davey, so don't get carried away. It's for the team and everything.
Okay.
Can you just tell me right now, what are you feeling?
Well, I'm down here in Fedderton-Sea looking out on the mist. I'm not feeling great, to be honest with you.
Okay.
But I'm hoping that during the day, that the elation will rise, and certainly we're looking forward to tonight's game. All very proud down here of one Mr. Furlong, representing the parish and the club and the province and the country with such distinction. Absolutely elation down here at the moment.
And I have Brendan there as well. And Brendan, you're the current president. Good morning.
Good morning, Brenda. How are you?
B&B, there you go. What are the plans for tonight? I'm trying to get a sense of the excitement and the buzz around the area.
Well, I suppose in the club itself tonight, we have the club will be open tonight for the game, and everybody is welcome, for both club members, non-club members. We'll be showing the game on two big screens. We expect we had a big crowd for the last game. We expect an even bigger crowd tonight, and some of our youth players, everyone else will be there as well. So look, we're really looking forward to it. These are the days you dream of, and it's great to have them. And we're just so lucky to have Tadhg as one of our own. You know, it's just great for everybody. It puts everybody in good humour. So really, really looking forward to tonight.
And I believe Tadhg's commitment to the club, because you mentioned the two television screens, he actually bought one of them. Is that correct? Give me a sense of his connection and roots still with everyone in New Ross.
I suppose with Tadhg, he bought one of the televisions, and that was David, myself, had a conversation with him about 2 years ago when David organised a revamp in COVID of our clubhouse. And he said, what did Tadhg do for us when we're doing the clubhouse up? And we said, Tadhg didn't do anything for us. So he said, Tadhg, what do you want? As Tadhg said, you know, that television you have out in your house, Tadhg, that nice big television, wouldn't that look lovely on the wall here in the clubhouse? I said, how do you know about that? We said, well, we were out with your dad watching a match out there. We said, it'd be nice to have. And he said, how would I get one of those? I said, Tadhg, look, you're a man of means, a man of, you know people and that more so than we. So about 2 weeks later, James's dad rang and said, hey, the young fella left a box here for you.
And now, somebody who mightn't kind of, you know, just go, oh, he's amazing, because you know what siblings are like. His brother is there, his older brother. Owen Furlong, a very good morning to you. How are you today?
I'm good, Brenda. Thanks, yourself?
Oh, I'm not too bad. I'm very, how are you feeling? Are you nervous? Are you calm? What's the current state of mind?
I'm calm out.
Yeah. And do you just think... Calm. that because you're so calm, is it a family trait? Is that something that Tadhg will carry as he heads down the tunnel in Stade de France this evening?
I certainly hope so.
Mm. Now
he should be grand.
He should be grand. Come here. You both grew up on a farm. Can you tell me about the farm you grew up on? What kind of an impact that made on both of you, and particularly Tadhg with the rugby?
So it was a small dairy farm in Campoyle here in Wexford. We were both expected to help out when we were small lads and go out and milk the cows with my father after school and clean out sheds and stuff at the weekend and stuff like that. You know, it was pretty average small dairy farm family bringing up. Like, you know, we didn't get a holiday till we were 12.
And why was that?
Yeah, hands-on with milking and stuff. Yeah. You know, our holiday was go down to my grandmother in Cork for a week in the summer.
And you were lucky to get that.
We were lucky enough, yeah. It was a nice, happy place to be.
And do you think, right, and I know you, did you change from dairy then because, you tell me actually, Owen, didn't you change?
We changed from dairy in 2007 now. The reasons why you'll have to ask my father, but we changed anyway. We're just do a bit of dry stock now.
Okay. And do you think that maybe helping out in the farm would kind of help Tadhg as he, you know, leads on that team?
I suppose, listen, trying to block cattle is going to be the same as trying to block the Scottish lads tonight. Yeah. So standing in gaps and not letting them through.
And Owen, listen, my heart bleeds for you because I believe you're just being pestered locally and you're being hounded by your brother. Can you tell us?
I think on my last count it was 477 people asked me was I going to France for the match, and 477 people were told no. And you're kind of starting to see Tadhg everywhere now, even though he's over in France. I walk into my local centre there most mornings before I go to work and there's a big cardboard cutout of him standing right inside the door. But that's where he is this week, but last week he was down by the meat counter and the week before he was over by the bread and milk, so he's getting around.
He's very around. Hard on your own. My heart bleeds.
I'm sure it does. Yeah.
And listen, David, you have known Tadhg since he was a young man and an underage player. And you have seen his drive, his intensity. Can you tell me some of your kind of memories about watching him playing and when you said, my God, this young man, if he stays injury free,
he can
go all the way?
Mind you now, we've known Tadhg and Owen as young players, but Owen is not doing himself a lot of justice there.
She asked you about Tadhg, David.
So, as we will move on, Owen wasn't too bad either.
Right.
Tadhg, on the other hand, I think all and sundry in Euros knew from a very early age that the markings were on the wall if this guy could just stay injury-free. He had everything. He had the ability, he had skill, he had it in the head. He was just an all-round guy and really could play anywhere. And, you know, like even from underage, from playing under 8 or under 10, he really could have slotted in at under 12 or under 14 without any problem whatsoever. I remember one great day he was playing number 8 and he was playing under 14. And the poor unfortunate scrum half on the other side decided to pick the ball and run at Tadhg. Now, instead of catching the ball, Tadhg just caught your man and the ball and took off down the field. Well, my God, you want to see it. But I mean, it started at an earlier age. And I mean, the fact that it's no secret that his tackling skills and his handling skills were developed on the farm where the young calves came in. And should I put in a caveat here, no animal or no human was injured during what I'm going to say.
Okay.
He used to tackle a couple of, in trouble, please.
Ah,
yes, no, Brenda, you're in enough trouble as it is now already. But anyway, he used to tackle the calves when they'd be about maybe 5 or 6 days old. The father, go on, Tadhg, get in there. That's when Tadhg get in, and that's where he gets his tackling from. So no calf was injured, but what a lovely, like, I mean, a grounded fellow. What a credit, we'll say, to the parents, to his surrounding family, and even to the club inside. I mean, we wouldn't let him have a big head anyway. You know what I mean? He'd be just coming inside.
I'm just thinking Owen is sitting there and he's a bucket beside him. Am I correct, Owen?
Huh?
I said, you're listening to all this praise for Tig. You have a bucket beside you. You're probably going
here,
for God's
he had sake. His chance and he asked me to move on. What else can I do for him?
Brendan, just very briefly, the club, New Ross Rugby Club, tell me about the surrounding area. And it's a small club, really, isn't it?
We're a small club, New Ross, but it's, like it says New Ross Rugby Club, but it's really New Ross District. Like we are, you know, I suppose, unlike, you know, maybe Jay and soccer and that, we only have four rugby clubs in the county. So we're lucky that in New Ross, we draw from South Kilkenny and we draw all the way from New Ross down to Hook Head. So we have Campyle and Ramsgrange and Feddert. And on the other side, we have Adamstown, we have South Kilkenny, Greignamana. So we draw from a big area. So it's very much a community-based club. We've 24 teams at the moment. So we've over 300 kids from 6 up to 18 playing with us. So it's, you know, it we're serving more than just, you know, it says New Ross, but it's really New Ross District.
All right. Well, look, we're coming towards the end of the programme. The day of preparation ahead of the match just begins for everybody. Can you just give me, can I go around and get a very quick score, how you think Ireland are going to do against Scotland? Can I go to you, David? What do you think? What are we going to win by, sir?
That's a great one. We're definitely going to win. I just think the calibre of this team, the steeliness is there that hadn't been there before, because heretofore what would happen was we'd maybe play South Africa or play New Zealand.
How much are we going to win by? Sorry, I'm rushing
points,
you here.
Nine points.
And what about you, Brendan? What about you, Brendan?
I think 10 to 12 points,
to 12. And Owen, are you proud at this
10
moment?
10 to 12, yeah.
10 to 12.
Yeah, I think the score, I think 22-10 will be the score.
Very good. We'll check in with you after. One very quick question. Are you proud of your brother as he's going
extremely.
To stand out?
We all are. Extremely. All of us are proud of him down here.
All right. Well, look, it's great to talk to you. Enjoy the rest of the day. And remember that the match will be on Virgin Media tonight from 8 p.m. And of course, you can listen to everything right here on RTE Radio 1. That is all we have for this morning. On sound was Harry Buckless. Our broadcast coordinator was Amadine Passo-Devine. The programme was produced by Eileen Hearn. Next here on RTE Radio 1 is Sinead Mooney with Playback. Until I speak to you again next week, come on Ireland, and thank you for listening.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1. Listen back on the RTE Radio Player.